We are going to have so much fun.
All right.
I promise.
I like that.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, yeah, thanks for having me.
So you know who Michael is friends with? It's not Graham. It's Colin. But I knew he came from somebody.
Colin Roche?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I love Colin Roche. How do you know?
My guy, college.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah.
But I just watched on the train home.
Yeah. Larry of Arabia.
Larry of Arabia.
Are you going to listen to me?
Yes.
It's 4 hours. You're going to have to watch it like a TV show.
I'll watch like a TV show. Right, I'll watch like 40 minutes a night.
It's 4 hours, but they digitally restored it for Netflix.
Is that with Jake Gyllenhaal?
Yeah, no. It's from 1962. Everyone's dead. Some of the best actors who ever lived, like literally whoever lived. And I'll let you watch it. I won't tell you anymore.
Thank you for
talking about Freaky Friday too.
Thank you for spoiling disclosure.
That doesn't sound like something I was going to put any
Lawrence of Arabia, digitally remastered for Netflix.
That's so different. Michael, I'm a big movie fan.
Okay.
And to the extent that I can, I like to raw dog everything. Meaning, I don't want to know anything. Like you can't avoid the trailer for Disclosure Day.
Yeah.
But I don't want to hear, I don't want to look at the reviews or Rotten Tomatoes. I just want to, with clean eyes.
That's fair.
Because I'm easily manipulated or influenced. The bar set too high, the bar set too low. So Josh gave a full review yesterday without me asking
of
for
Decision
that.
Day?
That was awesome.
Or of was what? It Disclosure Day? Day?
He's like, the aliens weren't that, I don't know, I'm not going to ruin it for anybody else. Like you did
it
for
I'm
me.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. I
gave a full,
you saw it.
Gave a full
I assumed,
review.
No, I was talking to you like you saw it already.
Give me a full review.
Seven out of 10.
So, well, listen, I do most of my movie watching on an airplane these days. So
yeah,
huge airplane movie guy.
Yeah.
I saw this in the theater. It didn't need to be seen in the theater.
Yeah.
But I figured it's Spielberg, it's Aliens. I'm going to go in the theater. It was like,
there was that whole like guerrilla marketing campaign about it, right? That like it secretly was actually going to disclose that there were aliens.
Yes.
That didn't happen.
Wait, did we decide?
Oh, yes, you were right.
I'm right.
Okay. He said, like,
about
Jesus.
How to say the name?
And I said, that's what Josh
My instinct was Jesus.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
I thought the Z might be silent. I wasn't sure.
No, it's a Greek name. And you know what? We say it wrong. Like, Jesus is the way my family says it, but it should be something more like Zezos or something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's too tough.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I'm like, I don't even say it the right way. It's Jesus, rhymes with Jesus.
I had another question.
Yeah.
You're the deputy.
Yeah.
Who's the head of research?
Katie Huberty.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
Okay. Buck stops with her.
Yeah. All right. I did know that. Yeah. She's great. All right. How are we looking? We doing good?
Yep.
She's an important man.
John, are you
only in my own mind.
Are you watching the World Cup?
What office do you work in?
I'm 1585.
Okay.
Times Square, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
How long have you been in that office?
That office since 2010. I've been with Morgan Stanley for 19 years. A part of that was in 522 Fifth Avenue when we still had that place.
Okay. Do you interact with the wealth guys?
Oh, yeah. Well, it started in wealth, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. It started, we had this SMA platform in wealth management, and that's I got started in munis and corporates there.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. All right. Cool. Well, we're going to have, I promise, we're going to have some fun today.
Good.
All
right. Good. We're good to go? All right. Do the click, Nicole.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Stop the clock. Here's a word from our sponsor.
It feels like there are two types of investing platforms right now. You've got the legacy brokerages that look like they were designed in 1997. And then you've got the new wave that looked at investing and thought, you know what this needs? Sports betting. Neither seem like a great place to build your wealth. That's where Public comes in. It's the modern investing platform for those who take it seriously. Stocks, options, bonds, crypto, they have it all. And the energy they're not spending on building a casino, it's going into AI. Public is the only investing platform where you can create agents that can monitor the market, manage your cash, and execute your trades. Just enter a prompt, approve the workflow, and put your agent to work. Go to public.com/compound to get started. That's public.com/compound, paid for by Public Investing. Full disclosures in podcast description.
Die richtige Business-Idee ist da, aber es fehlt an Zeit und Programmierkenntnissen?
Warum?
Der IONOS KI-App und Sitebuilder setzt Ihre Idee schnell und einfach per Chat-Eingabe um. Ob App, Website oder digitales Tool. Die KI baut es und mit nur einem Klick geht es live. Domain und sicheres Hosting auf europäischen Servern inklusive. Jetzt schon ab 9 € pro Monat starten auf ionos.de/app. IONOS. Digital an Ihrer Seite.
Welcome to The Compound and Friends. All opinions expressed by Josh Brown, Michael Batnick, and their castmates are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to, what did we say, 247? Episode 247 of The Compound and Friends. My name is Downtown Josh Brown, here with my co-host, Mr. Michael Batnick.
Hello, hello.
Michael, I swear this gets more serious as it goes on. Michael, yeah. Michael Zizas is joining us today. We're super excited about it. First time guest on the show. Michael is the Deputy Global Head of Research for Morgan Stanley, where he joined the firm in 2007 as a credit analyst and portfolio manager. In 2010, he became the head of municipal credit strategy, followed by head of U.S. public policy research in 2016. He has been a member of Institutional Investors All America Fixed Income Research Team since 2013, and by Smith's Research and Gratings as an all-star first team member from 2014 to 2021. Of course, in 2022, he fell off.
Yeah. It was a tough year.
Things haven't been as good since then, but yeah. We are going to revive his career today.
Let's do it.
All right. Dude, thank you for being here. Really
Thanks
appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
So Morgan Stanley, they seem to be doing okay.
Yeah, not bad.
Okay.
Not bad.
I
as
think,
a shareholder, I'm pretty happy.
I think Gorman was incredible. And you don't have to agree, but I'm sure you agree. But
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just he figured out if we're gonna build a true wealth franchise, what's the most important thing to the people working there? There have to be clients. There has to be demand.
It seems pretty logical.
Seems logical, but you'd be amazed. So a lot of large firms have wealth managers who have to go out and find their own clients or sitting around waiting for something to happen. And Morgan Stanley very brilliantly, I think, acquires E-Trade. They buy the business that's now Morgan Stanley at Work. And they just buy these funnels to push more people toward the wealth management people. And as a result, I think it's probably the fastest growing Wall Street wealth management business there. I mean, do you know if it is? Or I think it is.
That sounds right. I don't know exactly. But I mean,
it $20 trillion?
Yeah, that's what, in terms of
very
assets.
Very confident in my assertion.
$20
trillion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, that's right. Thanks. No, I
know you played a big part in that, but I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, like a little part for the few years I was in. But listen, I like to think that as someone who covered munis for a decade, spent a lot of time with our wealth management field effort, talking to clients across the spectrum. Listen, I'm biased because I'm in research. I like to think some of our intellectual capital had something to do with that too.
Of course.
And the ability for us to leverage that and to turn it into solutions for clients. So,
okay.
Still doing plenty of that.
Well, whatever you guys are doing, it worked.
All right.
How did you go from muni coverage, which is like one of the ultimate zoom ins on Wall Street, to like this big picture global macro dude?
Yeah. Well, I think it has a lot to do with how munis changed in 2008, 2009, right? So before that and before the financial crisis, everything in muni land was wrapped by the monoline insurers. And so you basically had one credit counterparty. It was the monolines. Everything was AAA. When that went away, all of a sudden you needed credit analysts to start looking at everything that was underlying. Right. And that was sort of dovetailed with everything that started going on with the sovereign debt crisis in Europe. There were all sorts of narratives that came into the market. I remember, like, the Meredith Whitney 60 Minutes.
Were you
moment.
on the muni side when that mm-hmm. Meredith Whitney scare took
place?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I mean, and I remember talking to hedge funds at that time, trying to explain the difference between Greece needing to roll over debt that was like 150% of its revenue in any given year versus California, which is paying like 5% in P&I.
Right.
Right. And so, getting into those discussions, you realize the public policy aspect of municipal credit was really, really important to clients at a micro level. And then, in terms of defining returns, I mean, it's a fixed income product, right? So, like, you were going to have a view about all the different sort of intersection of things that were driving treasury markets, not just monetary policy, fiscal policy, tax policy. So I sort of adopted this approach as a muni strategist. I was trying to be somewhat different than our peers, right? Like, muni strategy was this field where, like, everybody else had been around for like 20 years, and I was like the low cost option that got brought in, right? I was like, okay, well, instead of doing the thing where I'm going to like calculate carry and roll down at every tenor and say, this looks a little bit better than that one. Like,
let's— Oh, by the hospitals, not the roads.
Yeah. Right. Right.
There's my research.
Yeah. Like, let's look at this more from a macro perspective, not just like what's going on in the world, but also like, what are the big secular trends that govern the market, govern its behavior, establish priors that way, have a framework for setting up portfolios, and then iterate on top of that. And the heavy dose of that had to be tax policy during President Obama's first term, a lot of his healthcare policy. And so I got in the practice of having to be effectively like a DC watcher, a DC analyst. And I also have a master's degree in public policy. So it was kind of a natural place for me to say, okay, this may or may not become law. And if it does, I can tell you down to like the balance sheet and income statement level, what it's going to mean for this municipality versus that. In 2016, I was, I don't know, lucky or unlucky enough to be the person that the folks running the research department back then tapped to say, listen, clients are asking a lot of questions about what happens if Donald Trump wins. He's not going to win, but like, let's try and answer these questions on a multi-asset basis. Right. So I did that. It was a good stretch assignment. And then, of course, when he wins, the questions never stopped. It became this kind of permanent research.
So that's how
area.
You become like the public policy research guy within
pretty much.
The bank.
Yeah, okay. not by design, by accident. I felt like most of my good career moves have been by accident as opposed to design.
Yeah. But yeah. So, all right, but so everyone in the industry is getting those questions.
Yeah.
So, but you're at that time at one of the largest investment banks in the world.
Yeah.
So I would imagine the volume is higher.
Yeah.
But also the level at which people are making investment decisions based on what you say is significant.
Yeah.
You were also in uncharted waters. We had never seen a first presidential term like that.
Yeah.
So how did you navigate that and actually give people something that was meaningful, but not commit to something where you couldn't have possibly known the outcome?
Well, I think the first thing is we came into that environment with a really good collaborative culture as a research department. So I could define with a decent degree of conviction on my own, like what I thought a Trump presidency was going to mean in terms of this policy will happen, this one won't, and here are kind of ones that are uncertain. But in any case, you know, now let's like map out the fundamental impacts. And we had enough people with enough collaborative interest to do that, that we were able to put together roadmaps into the election in 2016. And then throughout 2017, we're like, okay, if tax policy happens this way versus that way, it's going to mean, you know, this fundamentally for this sector, let's compare it to valuation and right? So there was enough people to collaborate with and a good culture that we could work on a cross-asset, cross-region basis to map all this stuff out. So really, like, credit to my colleagues and to the culture of Morgan Stanley. You know, from there, it did start feeling like we were, like, chasing our tail a little bit. And this is where I always try to, if I can, like, carve out time to be like, can we step back and put together, like, a secular theme or, like, a framework that we think it's going to be durable for years. And so it became pretty obvious in 2017 that this was not business as usual. And a lot of clients were asking us the question, hey, like, when is this going back to business as usual? Okay. Like, you know, we were starting to flirt with tariffs. Those didn't come into play in 2018. But, you know, President Trump calling CEOs into the White House, like all sorts of stuff that just, you know, now seems like quaint, but then just seemed wild.
These were, to your point, these were bombs being dropped on the market on a daily. He would tweet at the CEO of Pfizer and voice his displeasure over drug pricing, and Pfizer would lose $50 billion in market cap.
Yeah.
Like, these were not trivial things. Now we look back and we laugh because, you know, none of those bombs actually detonated and did any lasting damage. But like, in that moment, market participants were like shocked. Like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
The White House is now a player on the chessboard.
Yeah.
And like, is the queen, frankly.
Right. So we'd be taking those style of questions from hedge fund managers, but then, you know, official institutions overseas, central banks would be like, okay, just like tell us how long we need to like white knuckle this until things go back to normal.
And then when is it going to be 2005 again?
Right.
Yeah.
And so, and my view was, and we ended up putting a lot of work around it, was like, things are not going back to normal. In fact, what you're seeing is kind of what American voters have elected. Maybe they haven't elected the tactical application of it. But when you kind of look back, a lot of things had changed underneath the surface. It's like Jake Sullivan, who was national security advisor under Biden, talks about it as the new Washington consensus. It's sort of very clear in hindsight. But the old Washington consensus was like, you know, whether you're Republican or Democrat, going back to the early 80s, all the way, you know, maybe let's call it until the financial crisis, you agreed on certain things. You're like, free trade's a good idea. The government should not be involved in the economy. Multilateral institutions are good, right? Soft power in the U.S. is a good idea. And now, if you look at like voter attitudes, they're like, we don't really see the value in any of that.
Yeah.
Now, maybe they don't see the value in like jacking tariffs up all the way or going to war in the Middle East, right? Or at least that's what the polling would suggest. But they don't see value in supporting some of those principles that were kind of key to this U.S.-led, principles-based, laissez-faire economics, international economic system that like everyone—
They didn't benefit them.
Right. Or at least they didn't see those benefits, right?
It benefited, but not in a direct enough way where they said, yes, I care about NATO,
yeah,
or I care about NAFTA, or I think it's good that China's in the WTO. Like,
yeah,
they either were very against those things because they hadn't seen any real wage growth in 15 years. And their communities had opioid addiction problems and they had family members who were sent into wars of choice. And
yeah,
they just looked around after 15 years of that shit. They were like, this isn't helping me. I'm not getting ahead. The economy is leaving me behind.
Right.
I want to vote for volatility. I want somebody to break everything.
Yeah. And so like you could see that right in front of your face.
Right.
And if the counter argument is, well, let me explain to you why free trade has been really good relative to like a past you didn't actually experience. Yeah, what's that saying? When you're explaining, you're losing, right?
Yeah.
Like, so that's not to say that voters have elected the optimal outcome here, but it's what they've chosen, right?
So you arrived at that in the late 20 teens, like not only is this very different, but also it's not going back.
Yeah.
And it's probably going further.
Yeah, and so this was the genesis of our whole multipolar world thematic.
So brag about that because you were right. This is I'll quote you to you and then you can react. Okay. From 2020, our call was and is that there's been a regime change driven by shifting voter preferences. And with it comes the need for financial decision makers of all kind to invest with the understanding that the best benefits of globalization were behind us and that geopolitical fragility is on the rise. Okay, great. Yeah. We're 6 years hence. Great call.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, now, identifying this early was, I think, important, but it was also sort of complicated at the time to understand when these trends would actually manifest in, like, real, you know, tangible, investable themes, right? Because, you know, we said with a high degree of confidence, like, trade barriers are going up, they're not coming down. Right. And, you know, obviously Biden was president in between Trump's two terms. And we always run an investor survey ahead of the election. And the investor survey ahead of 2020, most investors said, you know, that Trump winning would be better for markets than Biden. But if you answered Biden was better for markets, you were also very likely to answer a separate question on the survey that said, oh, well, Biden's going to take tariffs down.
We're going to roll them back.
Right.
And then we didn't.
Which was wrong because it's not as if the Democrats and Biden wanted to go back to some free trade norm with China. And in fact, they kind of want to do the opposite, but their tactics were very different. So, of course, you wouldn't bring down tariffs proactively if you're trying to negotiate with China. So the point that like the direction of travel and trade barriers, whether they're going to be tariff or non-tariff driven, was pretty obvious. The direction of travel on industrial policy, which is to say the government getting more involved, was pretty obvious. So you just needed time to work out in terms of manifesting into, okay, money being spent on, for lack of a better term, reindustrialization.
Reshoring, onshoring, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and then of course with the U.S. sort of exercising a different stature on the global stage and some of these geopolitical conflicts coming together, Russia, Ukraine, now the U.S. and Iran sort of highlighting some very critical choke points, you know, corporate America, C-suites across the globe kind of get the message. Like we can no longer sort of optimize for globalization. We need what our investment bankers call an anti-fragile strategy. So you're starting to get these supply chain shifts to work around those choke points, to work around those other sensitivities. Some of them self-imposed by the U.S. or trade barriers to say, we don't want people doing this kind of business in China. And it takes a long time and a lot of money to rewire.
I would say no
things.
Stock better exemplifies what you're talking about than Intel. So this is a company that was ridiculed for having adopted the strategy of, we're going to be the fab that's based in North America, not Taiwan.
Yeah.
And we are going to build microchip plants in Arizona because, of course. And the stock price, I think, derates, I don't know, 20 multiple points.
Yeah.
It's almost like a single digit. It almost trades like an automaker. And then they start losing money. And all of a sudden, there's this idea driven in part by what you're talking about, White House directly, but also sort of the needs of the industry post lockdowns and post inflation is like, we can't rely on just chips from Taiwan. We need to actually have stuff that gets made here. And there's a total rethink on Intel. And then they join the AI parade.
Yeah.
And then you see a stock go from, I don't know where it was, $15 to $80.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of market cap along the way. Do you think that's like sort of what we're getting at?
Yeah. And it's a good example here of some of the policy continuity, right? Because obviously the government took a stake.
They take a stake in Intel, which is a big departure.
And where'd that come from? That came from the CHIPS Act, which was something that was completed on a bipartisan basis when Joe Biden was president.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually a fair amount of continuity across these industrial policy choices. And I'd argue, you know, like we're starting to get questions about the midterms and midterm elections. I think that's going to be a lot more noise than signal, any outcome there. There's not a lot of policy change that comes out of different midterm election outcomes. Policy continuity is actually far more important. So that, and like, listen, we haven't even started talking about AI yet. You sort of have, like, AI is kind of this like exogenous technological shock driving tons of CapEx. And then I'd say largely like a policy driven, impetus to just, well, we're going to spend a lot of money to rewire global commerce in a way that we think suits our values better. Is that economically optimal or not? I think an economist would probably say not, but it almost doesn't even matter what the answer to that question is. But
it's good for winning elections. So that's why it's the policy.
Well, and either way, we're going to spend trillions of dollars trying to figure it out.
Michael, I think it's really hard to draw a direct line from policy to investing all of the time. You say it's noisy now. I think it's always noisy.
Yeah.
And I think maybe this has an inkling to do with the rise of the prediction markets. Because there is so much geopolitical uncertainty. And even if you get a policy call right or whatever, you then have to nail how investors are going to react to that.
Yeah.
And now it's like, well, F all that. Let's just go straight to the source. Like, will this happen? Yes or no? I don't have to bet on this and then industrials.
Will the Democrats take the House or not? I don't need to figure out what stocks to buy.
Right. Will CPI come in? Will CPI come in hot or cold? And then I have to figure out, well, man, are stocks extended?
Do I buy gold? Do I sell gold?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, no, so listen, if you're talking about a sort of, first of all, we really like prediction markets as another probability assessment of what's going to happen. I don't think I have any edge on predicting election outcomes. We know the uncertainties implied by polls. Okay, I think sometimes people put a lot of false precision on polls. If you treat them with a healthy amount of uncertainty that they deserve and you understand polling errors, none of the election outcomes over the last, few cycles would have been all that surprising. Prediction markets, I think, are just like another very useful comparison to the polls, and they help you with that. To the extent you want to express like a pure view on a certain outcome, like that matters. I mean, the world that I travel in tends to be like, well, can I use prediction markets to hedge a certain outcome?
Yeah.
And that's far more complicated because—
But tying policy.
Yeah.
And sorry to cut you off, but tying policy to investing, that's not easy. It's intellectually very stimulating, but that's really hard.
Well, because my thought is this, like if you understand the long-term implications of a policy choice, which can't be done in a vacuum. Like it can't, like we, you know, when, if we think, you know, like going into last year, like, okay, we knew tariffs were going higher. Were they going to go as high as like the average effective rate of like 30%, which is kind of where, you know, things were going on Liberation Day? Were they going to settle somewhere in between? You know, we had a base case written down of somewhere in between. I think the average effective rate is sitting in like the sort of like 12 to 15% range now. That's roughly where we were coming into last year, though we had it kind of kicking in more later. Well, then we've got to, okay, so we can apply that to goods. We've got to work with our economists. We're going to feed through in the inflation forecast. That's going to feed into central bank policy. That's going to feed into every single macro market estimate that we have. And obviously to the, we're dealing with, you know, the consumer analysts and anyone else who's affected by it to make sure that like, okay, we think we understand the policy. Here's multiple scenarios for it. Now you have to contextualize that within all the other sort of variables driving the price of your asset class. So in that sense, like there, we don't really put together playbooks like this policy equals, you know, X or Y.
You can't because there's got other things happening.
It's a multivariable problem.
Well, that's a great example. Yeah. So last year, if in January I had told you 2 months from now, the president's going to sit in the Rose Garden and put this poster board up with specific tariffs for every country, and some of them are going to be insane levels that nobody has in their estimates.
Yeah.
And then he's going to reverse because the stock market's going to have a negative reaction, but still, they're going to be 15%, let's say.
Yeah.
And in some industries, higher. And there's still going to be like all sorts of rhetoric about tariffs for the rest of the year. So yeah. I told you this last January. It comes to pass in March. Okay. Yeah. But had I given, not you, the colloquial you, had I given the street definitive, this is what's going to happen.
Right, the tariffs would everyone, be 5X higher, yeah.
So what would everyone do? They would immediately drop their earnings estimates, especially for industrials, and they would probably lower the multiple that we'd be willing to pay for stocks.
Yeah.
And in both cases, they would have been drastically wrong directionally.
Yeah.
So we had huge earnings expansion, which is the AI story. And we had, I think, multiples rising throughout the course of last year.
Yeah.
So that's why it's to Michael's question, like, even if you nail the outcome of a policy.
Yeah. It has to be considered, yeah, this is a multivariable.
There's too many other things.
And like in that, like last year, like much credit to Seth Carpenter and the economics team. A lot of our competitors went straight to recession call and
within like a day.
Yeah. And like we're not there. There's a lot of other things counterbalancing this in addition to the uncertainty around the negotiations themselves. So it has to be dealt with in that way. And listen, like I like to think that there's a reason that we try to have such a collaborative culture and such a like cross asset, cross region culture. It's because any of these problems affecting any individual asset class coverage area is a multivariable problem. And that's how we put ourselves out to clients. I'll say based on like our readership data, our follow-on engagement data, that's what they like. Like if you're doing collaborative work, you're going to get more than one standard deviation engagement than other folks. And it's you know, it's also, by the way, like what LLMs have a hard time doing. So we're just going to lean more and more
LLMs have a hard time doing?
Doing basically like with a simple—
Cross-asset or cross-discipline?
Cross-discipline, cross-asset. And like, listen, maybe there are some agent orchestrations in the future which might help with that. But, you know, certainly right now, giving a generalist a big thematic question that has a lot of variable inputs into it and saying, figure this out working with an LLM— We get really low success rate with that. We've been testing that a lot ourselves. We talked to LLM optimization specialists. That seems to be low success rate. So it's something that even coming into the AI environment, we leaned into culturally because we thought there was a lot of alpha there. But now we think it's just increasingly a part of the strategy of how we have to service clients.
So we'll get to the AI stuff, obviously. But we mentioned the tariff stuff. And even if you could have predicted perfectly, not to belabor this point, but the markets move so fast these days.
Yeah.
So fast. So you could be thinking about the implications and the market could be pricing in, you know, whatever is going to eventually happen. John, can you throw up chart 4, please? We're looking at the policy uncertainty index versus the VIX. And there is a gigantic spread between the two. And usually they're directionally correlated, but there seems to be such a heightened level of geopolitical uncertainty that is not really translating into equity markets. And you saw this during the war, where everyone's scratching their head. It's like, wait a minute, this was supposed to be the black swan event. Yeah. Everybody was expecting, if this happens, all right, S&P limit down, crude ups, whatever, doubled. And
like for 30 years, someday we're going to bomb Iran and they're going to close the Strait of Hormuz and it's going to be lights out for the global economy. Yeah. And I think the VIX got to 50.
Maybe, for
5 minutes.
The transmission mechanism between elevated geopolitical uncertainty and equities and fixed income and other instruments, it's a really weird disconnect.
It is. And I've got theories. I don't have any great explanations, but I think one of them is, I think when you're dealing with something that taken to its logical end, it is potentially existential for the economy and markets, maybe sometimes your optimal strategy is to put a really low probability on it actually going all the way through, you know.
So World War III.
Right.
What was that story that R. Cashin said about the bombs?
Yeah, Cashin from the New York Stock Exchange told a story about his first week at work, his early 60s. And the rumor going around the floor was the missiles from Cuba were in the air. So he's running around trying to get sell orders off, and his boss grabs him by the collar and says, "Art, what are you doing?" He said, the missiles are in the air. I'm selling."
Yeah.
He said, No. You buy when the missiles are in the air. Because if they hit, who cares?
Yeah.
If they don't hit, that's where all the money is made.
And
there were no missiles, thankfully.
Yeah. I mean, Liz, I hate to be so like cavalier about it, but I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. I mean, I can't remember if it was 2017 or 2018 when North Korea was testing a bunch of missiles, and there was a lot of rhetoric between the U.S. and North Korea going on. And, our Korean investors wanted some research around that to help them navigate and hedging. And you're like,
Is
there really a hedge?
Research?
Yeah, right. So
dig a hole.
Right. So, I mean, not to suggest that Strait of Hormuz closure is nearly as existential as that, but it's not irrational, in my view, to presume that an administration, which has shown itself to be sensitive to economic, not perfectly sensitive, right? I'm not one of those people who's like, the White House is never, is going to react. Sometimes we get the question, like, what percentage down does SPX have to be before the White House reverses course? I'm like, it's not that simple. But at least there is some sensitivity.
It's not that far off either. I think the White House is aware of the 200-day moving average.
Yeah.
I think the Fed is too.
Yeah.
And I think anybody that suggests otherwise is just not really paying that close attention. Yeah. But we seem to pull rabbits out of hats. We get in the vicinity of like an actual downtrend. I don't think anyone wants to cause a bear market, especially if they're just giving speeches.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. I guess the end thing I would say is it's not irrational for investors to see positive outcomes around some of these friction points. And then, of course, they could be proven wrong over time.
Well, they were right. I mean, the other thing is earnings estimates kept rising, and 100% right.
Yeah.
Before we do the AI story, which we'll finish with, I do want to get to investing in a multipolar world. And this is new for most people who are in the market. They haven't been alive at a time where all of a sudden the Europeans and the Japanese decide it's in their best interests to not just leave everything to America and to start thinking about their own ability to build and mechanize and defend. And to me, like, that's one of the bigger changes of this era. And it sort of, I guess, started with the Ukrainian, the conflict in Ukraine. And then I guess Israel and Iran, and it's just like every step forward seems to make the numbers go higher. Let's put this chart up, total reinvestment and reindustrialization in Europe and the U.S. Not that this is all military, obviously, but just this idea, everybody needs their own supply chains.
Yeah.
Germany, France, Italy can't just be tourist destinations. They have to be industrialized countries again. And they have to get serious about not relying on China or the U.S. And that, I think there are huge investment implications. And I think they're actually positive.
Yeah.
So I look at overseas stocks last year, had a great year. And maybe sometimes what certain country markets need is a little bit of fear and a little bit of paranoia for the animal spirits to get going.
Yeah.
And it's not ahistorical to suggest we've had some great bull markets as a result of building for war. It's just reality.
No, that's historically accurate. There's another way to say it. But I mean, if you're going to spend on capital and productive capacity, whatever it's catalyzed by, at least in the early stages, it's basic algebra in terms of how it drives growth. You know, there's always the lingering questions, and the questions will linger for AI also about like what's the ultimate ROI on this. But I just don't think we're not
there
yet.
Does that make these countries more does that make Japan, does that make developed ex-US more investable from an equity perspective? The fact that these countries are now going through this sort of cathartic moment where they're shaking off the post-World War II stasis. Yeah. And they're getting serious now about reindustrializing.
We think so, but would like nuance it a bit differently for like Europe versus Japan. Right? Like Europe is about industrialization, defense, and Marina Zavalok, who's our European equity strategist, has a good theory of the case around Europe being kind of a sneaky AI beneficiary, right? Just because of how, asset heavy those businesses are and how like there could be some good productivity gains there.
It's not asset heavy, it's heavy asset. He had an acronym.
You're right, I'm sorry.
If you've heard about this.
We'll allow it.
Sorry.
We'll allow it.
Halo. I know. In Japan, there was already some stuff going on before all this came into play, right? There was a lot of corporate governance reform.
A little bit more nationalism than we've seen in a few decades.
And then kind of like some healthy inflation creeping in. And like, by the way, you've got a household base there that like 50% is invested in deposits. I think the number is about like $7 trillion. So
risk averse.
Right.
Sort of sclerotic markets. Well, but there was, they're getting better now.
For a generation, there was not really a reason they had to think differently.
Right.
So the short answer is yes. So just like nuance it a bit based on each region.
Okay.
Yeah.
Today's show is brought to you by Vanguard. To all the financial advisors listening, let's talk bonds for a minute. Capturing value in fixed income is not easy. Bond markets are massive, murky, and let's be real. Lots of firms throw a couple flashy funds your way and call it a day, but not Vanguard. Vanguard bonds are institutional quality. Institutional quality isn't a tagline. It's a commitment to your clients. It means top-grade products across the board. The lineup includes over 80 bond funds. They're actively managed by a 200-person global squad of sector specialists, analysts, and traders. So if you're looking to give your clients consistent results year in, year out, go see the record for yourself at vanguard.com/audio. That's vanguard.com/audio. All investing is subject to risk. Vanguard Marketing Corporation Distributor.
Die richtige Business-Idee ist da, aber es fehlt an Zeit und Programmierkenntnissen?
Warum?
Der IONOS KI-App und Sitebuilder setzt Ihre Idee schnell und einfach per Chat-Eingabe um. Ob App, Website oder digitales Tool. Die KI baut es und mit nur einem Klick geht es live. Domain und sicheres Hosting auf europäischen Servern inklusive. Jetzt schon ab 9 € pro Monat starten. Auf ionos.de/app. IONOS. Digital an Ihrer Seite.
I want to ask you about AI because it's almost like to discuss anything else misses probably the biggest cycle of CapEx that any of us will ever see.
Yeah.
If the numbers even get close to the projections, is it like $15 trillion over the next 10 years or whatever people are saying? I mean, who knows, but
you guys have an estimate for $2.9 trillion in global CapEx.
That's just for
25 to 28.
Till 28.
Yeah. And that's just for the data centers.
And that's before the robots even show up.
Yeah.
And that's before everything goes autonomous. And that's before Mars. Like there are a lot of other things So are we like in the fourth inning of AI spend, or is this like, has the game even started yet? How do you talk to in groups of investors about whether or not they've missed a lot of the gains, or like what's still to come? Is there room to make new investments today?
Yeah, I think there's plenty of room. I don't know if it's first inning or fourth inning. It's early.
I think nobody really knows.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, so Stephen Bird, who runs our thematic research team, and talk about people who started their career in one area and they become specialized and really valuable in another area. He was our energy and utilities analyst for years.
Okay.
Utilities, very sleepy area, but gets pulled into becoming an AI expert because, well, all this stuff's got to get powered.
Yeah.
And like no one knows more than him about whether or not we can power this and how it's going to happen and the step functions.
Oh, that's it. That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And he's great. He runs all of our thematic research now. So I think the short answer is in terms of the build out, still pretty early stages in terms of the compute that the hyperscalers say that they want to develop, right? And so whether or not you think the hyperscalers are going to get, you know, super high ROI or something that's good, either way, like they're going to pay to develop a lot more of it. And the sort of governors, the constraints around that build out, which are energy and labor, maybe a little bit of policy, if anything sort of like is making that a bit earlier stage, things are going maybe slower than the people who want to invest in this.
So this gets back into your area of expertise. We know there's big concentration of data centers in Virginia for reasons that are really interesting. It's where AOL started.
Yeah.
Saying the first data center was there to serve them.
Yeah.
And then as a result, it's like the data center capital of the world.
Yeah.
But you are starting to hear stories about communities that either for environmental reasons or for the reasons of we don't like AI.
Yeah.
But you're starting to see sort of grassroots. It's not very loud. I don't think it stopped anything of consequence, but
the concept of AI definitely has like a PR problem.
Big time.
You're seeing it manifest in kind of a nonpartisan way, right?
It's
Virginia, California, Oklahoma. Like, you know, it doesn't
It's not
really,
red or blue.
Yeah.
It's different people objecting to it for different reasons.
Right. It's a risk we have to watch. It's not yet big enough relative to the build out and where build outs can happen around data centers and other, you know, like other parts of the infrastructure for it to like matter all that much, but we have to watch it. But the other thing I'd say, cause you're like, is it early? Is it not? You know, our economics team has about a quarter of GDP growth this year coming from just like the build out of the current build out of AI, like really very little baked in from a productivity perspective. So that's the other aspect of
it. Oh, just the construction aspect of it is driving
laying
down pipes and building structures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do you think a productivity boom is coming?
Yeah, we think so. I think it's hard to time it exactly, right? I mean, listen, speaking to someone who's actively trying to put AI into all of our processes in the department. And, you know, my boss, Katie Hubert, he's been like very forward looking on this. And even before I stepped into this position, sort of driving this and all sorts of like innovative takes on the future of research that require AI being linked into the process. Industrializing this stuff in large organizations and unlocking that productivity is, you know, sometimes easier said than done. The individual productivity that somebody might be experiencing at home, or if they're starting a business from scratch using some of these tools, that could be mind-boggling. But inside of a large organization where you're linking workflows and people together, it could take time. My only point being that, like, do you see major productivity gains, you know, this year, next year, the year? It wouldn't surprise me if it still takes a little bit. Like, the direction of travel is pretty clear.
Don't you have to see it in tech companies themselves first? And they're already very productive companies. But it struck me that, like, we're selling all this AI and we expect the recipients of the technology to be able to run their businesses more efficiently.
Yeah.
And, of course, we want to hear about restaurants with rising profit margins.
Yeah.
And we want to hear about hotel companies and insurance companies, of course.
Yeah.
But like, wouldn't the first place we see it be at the technology companies themselves who are actually developing the tech?
And I mean, and listen, just going by what they report about themselves, they're seeing that. And I'd say that our team does a lot of primary research on this. So we cover about 3,400 stocks globally. Stephen Bird and Katie will do this thing periodically where every analyst has to sort of map their coverage into whether you're an AI enabler, an AI adopter, a beneficiary, and to what degree based on your assessment of the company. and then we'll do surveys of the management of those companies. And we'll also scrape the transcripts, the earnings transcripts of those companies to see like who's actually reporting something tangible about.
So is it 20% of the S&P seeing tangible benefits in their financial statements from the use of AI?
Yeah, so
50%?
It's like, so like MSCI World, the numbers exactly right, but like it's, I think at the beginning of last year it was like 20%. We're up into like the 30s now. So it's climbing. And then for companies that we mapped as AI adopters, from 2024 to 2025, the average EBIT expansion was 2x faster than the non-adopters. Okay. So the benefits are there. They're starting to rise. But to the point of it, like specifically translating into like GDP, like that's a bit of a different measurement problem. But in any case, you're starting to see the tangible benefits show up in earnings for sure.
So right now it is a lot of charts in here. John, let's pull up chart. My God. I sound like Mike Francesa. Which chart are we looking at? Chart 20.
You wish.
Chart 20.2. Okay. We're looking at the consensus 2027 EPS change for AI infrastructure stocks. Insane. 42%. The S&P 500 at 10%. And the S&P 500 X AI infrastructure, just 3%. Man, this better go up for this to work.
Yeah.
I think it will. But.
No, I mean, we think it will too, but you're right. There's been this, at least in terms of like the broadening theme. Okay. And this is not my area of expertise, but you know, so I'm going to do my best Mike Wilson for a second here. There's been the divergence between the, you know, actual earnings broadening and like the price broadening out. And we expect those things to reconcile, but you're right. Like it hasn't shown up in enough places quite yet.
Meaning stocks are front running that. Like, are you saying this?
No,
stock,
like,
or backwards?
The other way.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a good year for the S&P on a headline basis. But percent of stocks positive is below average, not substantially
yeah. Yeah,
so.
It's average.
It's about average.
Yeah.
We keep hearing that the next leg of this bull market will happen away from the AI hyperscalers
and
will broaden out to the rest of the market. And like, obviously every sector has its own reasons for rallying or not rallying. Yeah. Energy is obvious. Housing related is obvious, like what the drivers are there. But do you guys, as a house view, do you guys think we actually even need this broadening out and we need to see all these AI users start beating earnings? Or can we just continue on the way we've gone with this sort of concentrated subset of AI champions driving all the growth and the market hold up?
It's an interesting way to phrase the question. I don't know if we'd say you need it, but that's the way we think it's going to happen.
You think it'll play out that way?
Yeah.
So that'd be
yeah.
very positive for yeah. a lot of investors.
Yeah.
Okay. Because people that are not exposed enough to AI are looking at the tape and they're saying, why is everyone having so much fun?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so we do a sort of big collaborative mid-year and year ahead outlook process every single year where you bring together all the strategists, the economists. And for the last two cycles, been pretty consistent on broadening out of equities in the US, plus some of the secular trends we talked about overseas and equities, kind of lean things. And it's not that bonds are a bad place to be, but they're going to serve more as a diversifier, coupon-like returns, et cetera. Because you're in a, you know, secular enough growth environment driven by a lot of these kind of, you know, major CapEx trends that, you know, that's going to be the norm for a couple of years.
What's interesting? We're seeing this right now. The Mag 7, like Meta and Microsoft, I know it's just two, and they're acting like shit. And NVIDIA got smacked down after trying to break out. It's not acting awesome. The Mag 7 are up 70 basis points year to date. The equal weight S&P is up 11%.
Yeah.
The NASDAQ 100, this is wild. You have the Mag 7 are flat, which is 40% of the Qs. And the NASDAQ 100 is up 19% year to date. I don't know what the equal weight version is. It's obviously got to be more than that. So the NASDAQ equal weight is up. Delete this, John. It's not up more than that. But whatever. The NASDAQ 100 is up 19% year to date. Yeah.
without its largest stocks doing all that much as a group. So, all right, so maybe that broadening thing is already
taking
place.
Okay, here it is. This is what I was looking for. Equal weight tech. Again, the Mag 7 are flat. Equal weight tech, RSPT is the ticker, is up 39% year to date.
Mm. Yeah.
So we got the broadening. We got the broadening in tech.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, that's a crazy spread.
You gotta start somewhere.
I want to ask you about the midterms. Are you getting a lot of questions from investors, hedge funds, whatever? You said earlier in the show, you think it's mostly going to be noise that comes out of that, and there will be policy continuity. Is there a way where that goes wrong, or what are people asking about this cycle?
I suppose the way that view is wrong is if either Democrats or Republicans win so big that they—
Which is not the forecast.
No. Well, and you asked about prediction markets earlier. I think coming in here, prediction markets had Dems at like an 80% chance to take the House and to take both the House and the Senate. It's kind of a toss-up, about 50-50. But if you map out—
Senate comes down to Maine— Basically, yeah, or
right, exactly. And it's like, and the thing is, right. So the point is, if it comes down to one of those states, you're talking about the Dems getting to like 50, 51 seats. But like, even if they got to 52, 53 seats, you don't have filibuster proof majority to push anything meaningful through. You definitely don't have the majority to overcome any veto. So if, you know, if clients question like, oh, well, is the tax cuts I got passed a couple of years ago, are those at risk? No, right? I mean, because I believe the Democrats are sincere in wanting to reform that, but they're not going to have the votes, and they certainly aren't going to have the White House for another couple of years.
Okay.
So it's more, and like, can they wrest back the power on like trade and tariffs? Again, practically speaking, not. Like, it is their, you know, Congress over years delegated that authority to the president. They can take it right back, but you need the votes in order to do
it. So there's no political shock. We don't think there's a political shock coming at some point this fall based on anything that we're seeing currently.
I don't think so.
And you're not giving people the impression that there's going to be some sort of fireworks.
Yeah, I mean, here's the caveat. Could there be knee-jerk reaction in the markets if you get a result that is surprising on election night in favor of a change of power, right? So, you know, Democrats effectively take control of both chambers, do better than expected. And the next day, the next week, you know, anything that's associated with like a positive, right? So, you know, the tax benefits from the OBBBA, you know, the sort of sectoral distribution of those, a lot of that's been sort of more small cap friendly. Like, could you see some temporary weakness there and like a knee jerk that, oh, this presages that 3 years down the line, there's going to be a major tax change?
No one's going to trade on that.
I mean, yeah, right. And if they did, I would say fade that, right? That's not the right way to think about it. Because in two years till the next election cycle, might as well be 100 years.
What's the most surprising question that you've gotten from an institutional investor or a hedge fund manager this year? What made you think the hardest, or what made you really have to go to the drawing board?
Well, I'll tell you what, like, we got a lot, when the Iran stuff started, there wasn't questions about whether or not Strait of Hormuz would become a choke point, but there were a lot of like very technical questions about like, you know, how much oil is going through, who can get it through there. You know, what are sort of the like puts and takes around like the Gulf Coast countries and their involvement. And that's another thing where we just had to like pull in a team effort. And
you're not a big Hormuz expert going into that?
No, going into it, no. I will say, like, I knew where it was on the map. I knew that
on the right side.
Yeah. All right. I knew that, like, well, it's just the contingency planning playbook. If Iran gets attacked, that's sort of the if they view it as existential.
You make it sound so obvious. I don't think our military knew that.
Well, it's
to have had a plan for that. So
it would be. I think our military probably knew that. Like, it's a question of whether or not you thought it would happen. And then, and I'll say this in fairness to that debate. You have to go back, I think, to, I'm not going to get this exactly right, but there was something called the tanker wars back in the 80s. It was like the last time Iran ever really shot at some ships. And it was widely thought it would be not in their self-interest to do that unless they felt like an existential crisis, because otherwise it would sort of turn the world against them. Well, clearly this feels pretty existential to them. In any case,
this breached that threshold where they said, yeah, we're doing this. Right.
Right. I mean, I think it's self-evident. So, so the questions we start getting are like really all about the technical aspects, how many ships can go through, under what conditions, et cetera. You know, credit to Martin Ratz, who's our commodities analyst out of London, who just knows the puts and takes of the oil market as certainly as well as anyone that I know. And to his ability to lean into using some of these AI tools that we now have for people, who's able to like wire things up pretty quickly using open source information to like map out, right, like exactly what could flow through at what rate, under which conditions. And so that was a hard question I got. I didn't answer it, but I knew, there, you know, this is, I think, a testament to the firm. Like, we can get you the right person.
Michael, what impact do you think all this AI and the ability for everybody to know everything really fast is going to have on markets? That's such a fascinating thing to think about.
That's a great question, because I think a lot of what we know or a lot of what we think about as being very smart people in markets, like that level of intelligence, I think is going to become table stakes pretty soon, right? The ability to layer Monte Carlo analysis on a financial model. Again, it's not like we're the first people who have ever thought of Monte Carlo analysis, but like now you can just do it really easily, right? And without having to like hire a statistician and have a supercomputer operating next to you. Or do like large scale document analysis, right? Like, let's score bond indenture documents. Let's do 40,000 of them a time. Let's map in the spreads and let's see opportunities. Like stuff like that, which I call like level three research, it was stuff that you just couldn't have done before.
You needed an army of bodies and now you don't.
Right.
Now it's a powerful chip.
Right.
And somebody that knows how to get the best out of the machine with the right prompt.
Yeah.
Which is a skill, I suppose.
But
you remove a big competitive advantage from gigantic research organizations.
Well, so you need the human judgment there also at the end of the day.
Right. So you remove the need to have a giant research. However, you also increase the possibility and the probability that people, like just like there's AI slop in, you know, like video and the stuff you see on like Instagram, there could be tons of like research slop, right?
You'll get overfit. Like the machine wants to please us.
Right.
It wants to give us what we seem to want, because it's every business on earth is now an engagement business.
Yeah.
Every business is Netflix and TikTok.
Yeah.
So the machine doesn't want you to turn it off.
Yeah.
So it will, to your point, keep asking the question. It'll eventually give you something that sounds right.
Yeah, and even like before I said, it's not like no one's ever heard of Monte Carlo analysis before, but just hearing about it and knowing how to do it the right way are two different things, right? So you said, I don't know if the word used was wisdom or experience, but like, actually, I think that's an important difference.
Judgment,
right. Like, what's the difference between wisdom and knowledge? Like,
the tomato is a fruit.
You got it.
But
you don't put it in a fruit salad.
That's knowledge. Wisdom is you don't put tomato in a fruit salad.
Right. So like, that's still really, really important. And I think you need a like network of experts to really sort through that noise, or you could start making some big mistakes in judgment. So what happens in the future when everyone's enabled like this? It might not look all that different than now, where there's, you know, people chasing narratives and that aren't right. And ultimately they get proven wrong and people are wiser and you know, operate better, more sustainably over time.
Before we let you out of here, can we do like a little Morgan Stanley research lightning round?
Sure.
Okay. What's the house view on employment in the AI era? Are you guys optimistic that the new jobs will come along on time so that we don't have like a big air pocket? Or do you guys think there are going to be some tough years for young workers before these new opportunities present themselves, or maybe some other option that I'm not thinking of?
I mean, I would say optimistic until proven otherwise, kind of like eyes wide open. So our economists have done a lot of work breaking down the sort of mapping the types of work in the economic data that map over to the skills that are considered disruptible. I'm trying to see where the unemployment cohorts higher and lower than others. And like you
legal and accounting.
Yeah. And like you squint, you see some difference in like youth unemployment, but like you got to squint at the moment. And so I'd say mostly optimistic, but vigilant.
Not that you're going to make stock picks, but enterprise SaaS, the SaaS apocalypse. Yeah. Was the Morgan Stanley outlook for, I mean, this is, I think, the standout negative group of the year.
Yeah.
And these are some very large companies, companies that you guys are probably covering all of them.
Yeah.
What is Morgan Stanley saying to people that ask about, are values being created there, or is it going to be harder than maybe to make money there going forward?
Well, I mean, I think both, it's going to be harder there fundamentally, and there's value being created. And we think a lot of what happened in the markets was overblown. The ability for these companies to industrialize in a way that individuals in a large organization, you know, might not necessarily be able to do things for themselves, it means that there's still a moat there.
You think that's enough of a moat that would justify investment in these companies, or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not expert enough to say on those specific companies, but just like conceptually, I would say like we're not a buyer of the idea that everyone's just going to write software for themselves.
Well, the Morgan Stanley research budget include as much money going to enterprise SaaS 3 years from now as it does today, or will compute and Anthropic bills eat a bigger chunk of that expenditure? Like, you obviously don't know for sure, but if you had to guess directionally, where does it seem to be heading?
I mean, it's a good question because it's hard to like distinguish between just like buying the tokens and then some of the other service providers that plug into them. I mean, listen, I think our budget going towards tech solutions probably going to be pointed higher, at least as a percentage of the budget. But like a lot of the solutions that that Katie and her team are putting together really boil down to making sure it's not just about like token usage. It's also about having the right data plugged in and the right sort of, you know, like use cases that kind of come from that. So I'm not trying to avoid your question. I just think it's not as simple. And like, we don't know.
Worst lightning round ever.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, too hard.
Yeah. How about yes? I'll say yes.
Here's an easier question. Right. How do Morgan Stanley clients feel about Kevin Warsh and the new Fed?
Yeah, I would say fine.
Bond market seems okay.
Yeah, right. I think
so far he hasn't had to do much, but
so yeah, I think the answer is fine, which is a boring answer, but there would be, I think, far more anxiety if you'd gone with one of these less traditional names that have been thrown out there. People are really embracing unorthodox economic
Kevin Hassett or somebody coming from pure politics.
Yeah, or someone who is perceived to be just somebody who's going to take a phone call from the White House. And like, but I would say this, even in that situation, we probably would have leaned against the concept that the Fed substantially compromised. As Seth and our econ team point out all the time, we're like, there's a whole committee there. There's not just one person. And so, sure, communication could get scrambled. It could get confusing, but it wouldn't necessarily, if you just looked back on it in history on like a chart with like what the policy rate was relative to inflation and growth, it might not look all that crazy. Now we don't have to deal with that hypothetical debate, really. I mean, we still have to pay attention.
He's traditional enough.
Yeah. Now let's see if we're right. I mean, we're about to learn, but yeah. So the short answer is fine.
Okay. So on balance, Morgan Stanley is like not the most bullish on the street, but you guys are pretty constructive on most asset classes. And sort of like if the earnings growth delivers, we don't get a worse geopolitical situation in the Middle East, and the interest rate picture is probably just more of the same. Like if those things hold constant, we should finish out the year in pretty good shape.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's largely buoyed by the secular trends and themes that are driving this around CapEx and AI and dealing with this transition to a multipolar world.
I want to tell you, we really learned a lot from you today. And thank you so much for coming to the show. Did you have fun today?
I did. And I really appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity.
You want to come back sometime?
Of course.
Are you busy tomorrow?
No. Yeah. What time? So, like 7:30 a.m. sharp? Okay.
Dude, thank you so much for being part of the show. Where can people find more from you and from your team? If somebody says Michael Zizas is great, I want to hear more of what he has to say. What's the right place to go?
Morgan Stanley Institute. Go to the webpage, sign up for the Morgan Stanley Institute newsletter. We're bringing together all the thought leadership across the firm for all types of financial decisions.
The Morgan Stanley Institute. This has been Michael Zizas. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you for watching. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
Die richtige Business-Idee ist da, aber es fehlt an Zeit und Programmierkenntnissen?
Warum?
Der IONOS KI-App und Sitebuilder setzt Ihre Idee schnell und einfach per Chat-Eingabe um. Ob App, Website oder digitales Tool. Die KI baut es und mit nur einem Klick geht es live. Domain und sicheres Hosting auf europäischen Servern inklusive. Jetzt schon ab 9 Euro pro Monat starten auf ionos.de/app. IONOS. Digital an Ihrer Seite.